Bon, donc on va reprendre la partie séminaire de cette séance. Et le séminaire, comme d'habitude, aura lieu en anglais. Donc je vais passer à l'anglais pour présenter notre orateur d'aujourd'hui. So today we have, I have the great pleasure to welcome Philippe Werner to give this seminar. Thank you, Philippe, for accepting to come and stay for a few days in our research group. I've known Philippe for many years. It's a pleasure to have him here. He's really a leading theorist in the field of strongly correlated materials and using and extending dynamical mean field theory in particular. He did his PhD at ETH, and already during his PhD, he really was part of a big breakthrough in terms of algorithms that allow to solve these problems of embedded atoms in the bath, what we call impurity models. You've heard about it in Michel's seminar last week. So these are these continuous time quantum Monte Carlo algorithm, in particular the continuous time hybridization expansion solver, of which he is a pioneer. This brought a real revolution in our ability to solve these dynamical mean field theory equations, but he didn't stop there. After his PhD, he went to Colombia, where he did a postdoc with Andy Millis. And I don't exactly remember when, but he became interested in the dynamics, out-of-equilibrium dynamics of many body systems, for which he developed and pushed considerably the methods of dynamical mean field theory out-of-equilibrium. In terms of physics, he has many, many contributions, but one that I like particularly and that I can't resist mentioning is that he also is one of the pioneers of the idea of Hund's metals that revealed the importance of the Hund's coupling to the physics of some strongly correlated metals like strontium ruthenate that I mentioned earlier today. Philippe is a professor at the Université de Fribourg en Suisse, and I will leave the floor to him. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, short one. It's really a pleasure to be here and follow this morning's lecture, and of course also visiting the group and talk to many, many people with whom I also had the pleasure to collaborate over many years. And so in this seminar, I'm going to follow up on Antoine's DMFT lecture and try to explain how we can extend the DMFT formalism to non-equilibrium problems. And the reason why we are interested in the non-equilibrium properties of correlated materials is because experimentalists are measuring these properties with ever increasing time resolution. This is typically done in a so-called pump probe setup, where the material here is driven out of its equilibrium state by a strong laser pulse, the so-called pump pulse, and then the properties of the excited material are measured with a weaker probe pulse that reaches the sample after a well-controlled time delay. And nowadays, the time resolution of these types of experiments, which can be, for example, photoemission, time-resolved photoemission experiments, is approaching 10 femtoseconds, which is roughly the intrinsic time scale of electrons in correlated solids. So one hope here is that by doing this, one can disentangle competing or cooperative effects on the time axis. As you know, in correlated materials, there are often very many competing or cooperative effects which are difficult to understand in equilibrium. For example, what is the electronic or phononic contribution to a charge density wave state is not easy to understand in equilibrium, but if these two contributions have different intrinsic time scales, one can hope to learn something by driving the system out of its equilibrium state. Then even more interesting is the prospect of actually changing in a controlled manner the properties of materials by driving them with laser fields. Here's a very simple idea. For example, we know that from cuprate physics that the properties of materials can change a lot. If we dope holes, for example, into a MOT insulator, some interesting phases, like unconventional superconducting phases, can emerge if we dope holes into a Mott insulator. So one may ask what kind of happens if we dope holes and electrons into a strongly correlated insulator by photo excitation across a charge transfer or Mott gap. By this way, one hasn't really found any superconducting phases, just ultra-fast insulator to metal transitions, but there are various claims of light-induced superconductivity in materials where one drives the lattice degrees of freedom resonantly by terahertz pulses. So one result from Faust and collaborators is the following. They looked at the kind of cuprate material where the superconductivity was suppressed in equilibrium due to competition from a stripe-ordered phase. And then by driving the lattice with light, they somehow eliminated this competing stripe-ordered phase. And then they found the kind of re-emergence of the superconductivity at the temperature at which superconductivity does not exist in equilibrium. Even more remarkably, there were recent experiments on fulleride superconductors, which have a relatively low critical temperature in equilibrium, about 20 Kelvin. You can see this in this equilibrium optical conductivity spectra by the opening of a gap in the real part of the spectrum and the kind of 1 over omega divergence of the imaginary part. And what they reported, if they excite this system now with laser pulses, which excite certain phonon modes on these buckyballs, is a change in the optical conductivity, a transient change, which very much resembles what you see if the system goes into a superconducting state. And the remarkable thing here is that this happens at temperatures which are far above the equilibrium superconducting transition temperature. So there may be a light-induced transient superconducting state realized in these materials. There are also very interesting experiments which do not involve superconductivity. For example, in tantalum disulfide, this is a polaronic Mott insulator. It was shown that by short laser pulses, one can switch this material into a so-called hidden state, that is a long-lived metastable state, which has properties which are different from any known equilibrium phase of the system. For example, it has a different lattice structure. It is also metallic in contrast to the insulating initial state. And there are already now some kind of memory devices built which exploit the ultra-fast switching between these two states. So that's, I think, also a very interesting avenue for future research to exploit and explore kind of the properties of such long-lived metastable states which can be induced by strong light pulses in correlated materials. Now, from the theory point of view, the simulation of these time-dependent problems poses a number of challenges. The first challenge is that we are interested in strongly interacting many-particle systems which are already in equilibrium, very difficult to treat, so we need some approximate techniques such as DMFT. The second challenge is that the perturbations which are typically applied to these systems are very strong, so we have to describe the time evolution far beyond some linear response regime. And the third challenge, which is maybe the least obvious, but one of the biggest challenges, is that if we drive a correlated system out of its equilibrium state, then typically the dynamics involves many different time scales. So the excitation happens on the time scale of femtoseconds, and then if the laser pulse has many cycles, the system can go into a so-called floque state, which may have properties quite different from those of the initial system, and after the pulse is off, the system starts to relax towards a new thermal state, but this can or typically happens in different stages. Initially, one often finds relaxation into a so-called pre-thermalized state where local observables look thermalized and non-local observables are still far from thermalized. And then in a system with long-range order, for example, antiferromagnetism or something like this, there can be slow downs in the dynamics due to the presence of so-called non-thermal fixed points and other trapping phenomena, and the true thermalization then happens on typically much longer timescales. And devising a scheme and a numerical kind of algorithm which can describe this time evolution over all these relevant timescales is a big challenge. And so what I'm going to discuss today is one of the kind of promising approaches, which is the non-equilibrium extension of dynamical mean field theory. So here's a brief overview. I will start again with a very kind of short summary of the dynamical mean field formalism, which we have just heard before. That's just to kind of fix the notation. And then I will describe how we can extend this formalism to non-equilibrium problems. I will also say a few words about the physical observables that we can measure in this type of Green's function-based technique. And then in the second part of the talk, I will discuss two examples which allow to illustrate what we can do with this kind of non-equilibrium formalism. One is a quench of a metallic system with an AC electric field. We suddenly switch on the periodic electric field in a metallic system, and we will show that this effectively allows us to change even the sign of the interaction in this system. And the second example will be an example of a non-equilibrium phase transition. We will push an antiferromagnetically ordered system out of its equilibrium ordered state, and we'll study how the order melts and what kind of trapping phenomena can occur in this dynamics. So here is again the analogy that we always use to motivate dynamical mean field, the dynamical mean field construction. So this is the famous Weiss mean field theory, where we map the lattice model of interacting easing spins to a single site effective model, which is a single spin in an effective magnetic field. And this magnetic field is then optimized in such a way that it mimics the effect of the kind of red spins onto this black spin. And this optimization is done in an iterative procedure where we, as a self-consistency condition, identify the lattice magnetization with the magnetization in the single site problem. And dynamical mean field theory, as we have just heard before, is a similar construction now for a Hubbard model or other similar fermionic lattice system, where we map a correlated lattice problem such as a Hubbard model onto a single site effective problem, which is a quantum impurity model. So we can kind of think of it as follows. We focus on one of the sites, which becomes our impurity site, and the rest of the lattice is replaced by a bath of non-interacting electrons. And then there is a self-consistency condition which allows us to fix the parameters of this bath. And very often it's useful to work in an action formulation where we integrate out the bath and replace it by a time-dependent hybridization function, which describes how electrons hop in and out of the bath as a function of time. And this, as we have heard, plays the role of the dynamical mean field, which is fixed by the self-consistency loop. And here is the explicit loop, which is used to fix this self-consistent dynamical mean field delta. We start from a kind of arbitrary guess for delta, and then we solve numerically this impurity system, which means we calculate the Green's function and self-energy, and then we do this approximation where we say that we approximate the lattice self-energy by this spatially local impurity self-energy, and with this approximate lattice self-energy, we can calculate the lattice Green's function, we can calculate then the local lattice Green's function, and finally impose the self-consistency condition, which is to demand that the local lattice Green's function is the same as the impurity Green's function, and that allows us to define a new hybridization function, and this loop is iterated until convergence is reached. So that's the DMFT construction. And I also want to remind you that DMFT can also treat long-range ordered systems with a, most simply with a two sublattice type of order, such as antiferromagnetism. In this case, the bath for sublattice B is fixed by the Green's function on sublattice A, and the bath on sublattice A by the Green's function on sublattice B. And then if we have, for example, pure nail order, there's a symmetry between spin up on sublattice B and spin down on sublattice A, and this allows us to collapse the two self-consistency loops into a single one, where at some point in the self-consistency loop we flip the orientation of the spin. So it's actually very simple to treat this type of order in dynamical mean field theory. So here is a sketch of the phase diagram of the Hubbard model that we get in dynamical mean field theory in the space of interaction and temperature if we restrict the solutions to paramagnetic phases. Yeah, so before we hear about the realistic phase diagram with long-range order, but if we artificially suppress long-range order, we get this kind of phase diagram where at high temperature we have this crossover from metal to MOT insulator, and at low temperature there's then a phase transition between the metal and the insulator, the so-called MOT transition. And if we allow for long-range order, in this case antiferromagnetism, this MOT transition disappears inside this antiferromagnetic insulating phase, as we have heard this morning. And then we only have actually a crossover from this Slater-type antiferromagnet to the Heisenberg-type antiferromagnet as we increase the interaction. There's also a symmetry at half filling between the repulsive and the attractive Hubbard model, which allows us kind of to map the two systems on each other, and therefore also on the attractive side we get a very similar phase diagram with, in this case, the antiferromagnet replaced by a S-wave superconductor, and this crossover from Slater to MOT type antiferromagnet becomes then on the attractive side the crossover from BCS to BEC superconductor. So the BCS is a superconductor with extended pairs, and BEC is a superconductor with tightly bound pairs. So in the following, I will then, or in the example section, I will discuss dynamics of antiferromagnets, but by this mapping you can easily understand that we would get the same phenomena if we would study also the dynamics of S-wave superconductors. So now let's discuss how we can extend this dynamical mean field formalism to non-equilibrium problems. And we will always start from an initial state which is in equilibrium and which is described by a density matrix rho zero, where the zero here is now time zero. That's our initial state, which is given by this equilibrium density matrix. And in order to describe the state at some later time t, we have to now time propagate this density matrix to a later time. And we can do this by multiplying with this time order, with these time evolution operators u, which are defined in this expression here. And then if we have the time propagated density matrix, we can calculate the expectation value of some observable O by the trace of this propagated density matrix times O. And now we can insert this expression for the propagated density matrix into this trace and use the cyclic property of the trace to move this red factor to the right-hand side. And then we are end up with this expression here, where I have already replaced the density matrix of the initial state by this explicit Boltzmann expression. And the final step is to replace these time evolution operators by time-ordered and anti-time-ordered exponentials. And we can also replace this Boltzmann weight by an imaginary time-ordered exponential. And then you see that the calculation of the expectation value at time t involves a time propagation along this kind of contour with three legs from 0 to time t. That's the red part here. Then we measure at time t. We propagate back along the real-time axis to time 0. And finally, we propagate along the imaginary axis to minus I beta, where beta is the inverse temperature. So this corresponds to the thermal initial state, and then these two branches to the real-time propagation.
So, Philip, just a question on terminology here. Why do you call it the Kalanoff-Fine contour and not the Keldysh contour?
Yeah, usually Keldysh contour is used for just the two branches. But yeah, I don't know if it's not totally sure if it's correct. But yeah, my understanding was, yeah, Keldysh is usually for just the real branches, and if one has also the third branch, which describes the initial equilibrium state, one calls it Kalanoff-Bine. Yeah. Yeah, should do some reading to see if it's correct terminology. Anyhow, so because this evolution along this contour is so crucial, it is convenient to define a time ordering operator on this contour, Tc, which orders, say, creation and annihilation operators according to these arrows here on this contour. And if we introduce this operator, then we can very easily kind of write our time-dependent expectation value as a contour-ordered expectation value. And this is then formally very similar to the imaginary time-ordered formalism, which we know from the study of equilibrium systems. Yeah.
So instead of, let's say, calculating the average of one operator at a single time, if it is a product of mm-hmm. operator at time t1 and time t2,
yeah.
how do you define it?
Yeah, exactly, yeah, in the same way. Yeah. So we can then just define a time ordering for two operators, which orders the times also along this, along this kind of contour time. So it's a kind of straightforward generalization of this contour time ordering.
But in the previous equation, when you had defined this O of t, you had used the density matrix at time t.
Yeah.
So now it would mean what?
Then you cannot so easily do this analogy to the one-time observable with the density matrix. But maybe, once we have introduced this operator, it's kind of straightforward to generalize this concept now to two-time observables, and then, the two-time observable which is of interest to us for the dynamical mean field calculations is this Green's function, which is d dagger d. And so because we have three branches on this contour, we have in principle three types of Green's functions, g, I, j, where I and j denote now the position on this contour. And I should emphasize that, for example, g, 1, 2, where we have the annihilation operator on branch 1 and the creation operator on branch 2, is not the same thing as g, 2, 1, where the annihilation operator is on branch 2 and the creation operator on branch 1. Because if we now think in terms of this contour time, the black dot here comes before the white dot in G12, whereas in G21, the white dot comes before the black dot. So these are two different Green's functions. And also, we have these beta antiperiodic boundary conditions, as in the Matsubara formalism. If we move one operator, here the annihilation operator, from the start to the end of this contour, we get the minus sign for fermions, and similarly, if we shift the annihilation operator from top to bottom, we get a minus sign. And that's basically it. So non-equilibrium DMFT is nothing else than just the usual DMFT implemented on this Kalanoff-Bine contour using non-equilibrium Green's functions. So the formalism remains exactly the same. We have exactly the same mapping from a lattice problem to a quantum impurity effective single site problem. And we have exactly the same approximations where we approximate the lattice self-energy with the impurity self-energy. We have the same self-consistency condition. The only difference is that these hybridization functions, Green's functions, self-energies are now objects which live on this Kardanov beam contour. And the other difference is that we, in general, lose the time translation invariance. So these objects are not just functions of the time difference, as it is the case in equilibrium, but they really explicitly depend now on the two time arguments separately. And that makes the calculations numerically more heavy to handle. Just, for example, the storage is already much more of an issue. We have now matrix quantities, which we have to handle rather than just vectors. And also these kind of Dyson equations, which we can very easily solve by going to Fourier space in equilibrium, become more complicated to solve in the non-equilibrium context, as I will explain a little more in a couple of slides. So, yeah, non-equilibrium DMFT is just solving these usual DMFT equations on this Kardanov beam contour. We have some impurity action defined on this contour, which has a local part, basically the Hubbard interaction and chemical potential, and then this hybridization function defined on this contour. And then we need some numerical method to calculate from this action the impurity Green's function, and I will not go into this in this lecture. This will be, I think, a separate lecture to discuss the kind of techniques that we can use to solve this problem. All I want to say is that we have tried more or less to adapt all the existing techniques that have been used in equilibrium to this non-equilibrium problem, and it works to some extent, but at the moment we don't have really the powerful method which allows us to easily do or reach the timescales that we want to reach. So in contrast to equilibrium, in particular Monte Carlo techniques run into very severe problems because of the phase oscillations of the time evolution operator on the real-time axis. This leads to a very bad phase problem, and so the most powerful technique that we have in equilibrium cannot straightforwardly be used in these non-equilibrium calculations on only up to very short times. And so for this reason, we then in practice often resort to approximate schemes, which are self-consistently resummed perturbation expansions, such as the non-crossing approximation. Anyhow, beyond the solution of the impurity model, there is the solution of the Dyson equation, which in non-equilibrium is not totally trivial. So in equilibrium, it's very easy. We can go to Fourier space out of equilibrium. It's not quite so easy. So let's briefly discuss how this is done. Let's look at the non-interacting lattice problem first. This non-interacting lattice problem defines a non-interacting lattice Green's function, and this non-interacting lattice Green's function satisfies some equation of motion of this form, which tells us that we can write the inverse propagator for the non-interacting problem like this, so a kind of differential operator IDT plus mu minus epsilon of k. And now to calculate the interacting lattice Green's function, we have to solve the lattice Dyson equation, which is written here in integral form, where in DMFT we substitute for sigma this impurity self-energy. But that, for this step, doesn't really matter. So now this is the integral form of the Dyson equation, and we can convert it by taking the inverse of this non-interacting propagator, multiplying with the inverse into this differential form. And now if we are in equilibrium and have these beta antiperiodic boundary conditions, we can easily solve this equation by going to Fourier space, and that's the solution which you all know from equilibrium DMFT calculations. Now, out of equilibrium, we have to be a little bit, we have to proceed in a different way. We have to go back to this equation and now really substitute here for the inverse propagator this operator IDT plus mu minus epsilon. And then what we end up with is this kind of integral differential equation for the lattice Green's function, where the self energy plays the role of a kind of memory kernel in this equation. And so the strategy for solving these equations is the following. We start from the equilibrium calculation on this Matsubara branch of the contour. That's exactly the equilibrium DMFT calculation. And then we extend the solution time step by time step along the real-time axis by step-by-step extending this length of the real-time branches. So we discretize the real-time. We then extrapolate the equilibrium solution to the first time step, and then we solve these type of Dyson equations plus the impurity problem for this time step until convergence is reached, and then we extrapolate the solution to the next time step, and we converge the DMFT equations on the next time step, and that's how we extend the solution time step by time step along the real axis. And the solution of such an equation by itself scales like the cube of the number of time steps, because basically we have this memory kernel sigma. And that means that already the solution of the Dyson equation is quite expensive. We have a kind of third power scaling in this step of the calculation. And then depending on what we use for the impurity solver, of course, we have a much steeper scaling for the impurity solver. But even for the, if we use the simplest approximations like second order perturbation theory or NCA or something like this, then the numerical cost for solving the Dyson equation is the same as the numerical cost for solving the impurity model. So this is not negligible. Let me briefly explain how an electric field enters into this type of calculations. The electric field can come from a scalar potential or from a time-dependent vector potential. The vector potential enters into the Hopping term and gives a complex phase to the Hopping term, whereas the scalar potential gives us a space-dependent effective chemical potential. Now, in DMFT, we always kind of assume spatial translation invariance, so it's not convenient to have this space-dependent chemical potential, and for this reason, we always work in a gauge with pure vector potential, so where the scalar potential is zero, and the electric field is expressed as the time derivative of the vector potential. And if we can neglect the spatial dependence of this vector potential, for example, because the variation of the field is very slow on the atomic scale, then we can easily Fourier transform this expression, and what we get is a shifted dispersion epsilon of k, where the momentum is shifted by this time-dependent vector potential. And if we go back to our DMFT loop, the only place where the dispersion enters is in the calculation of the lattice Green's function, so in the solution of the lattice Dyson equation. And so the only modification that is needed to describe a problem in an electric field is to replace here the epsilon of k by this time-dependent dispersion where we shift the momenta by the time-dependent vector potential. So it's at least conceptually very easy to extend these calculations to problems with electric fields. Now let me say a few words about spectroscopy. So we mentioned this 9 components of the Green's function. Not all of these components are independent. For example, if I shift the last operator on the contour from the upper to the lower branch, then nothing changes because the time propagation forward and backward here cancels. So there is a redundancy here. And there are similar There are similar redundancies, six redundancies like this, which allow us to eliminate three of these nine components and then to define six so-called physical Green's functions, which have names, retarded, advanced, Keldysh, and so forth. And now for this talk, what is relevant is the retarded Green's function, which is this combination, and the lesser Green's function, which is the G12, because the spectral function is the imaginary part of the retarded Green's function, and the occupation is the imaginary part of the lesser Green's function. In equilibrium, we have a fixed relation between these two. The ratio between the occupation and the spectral function is given by the Fermi distribution function for the temperature of the system. But out of equilibrium, this relation will no longer hold. So what do we do now in a non-equilibrium situation? We can still calculate a kind of time-dependent spectral function as follows. We introduce an average time and a relative time, and then we can Fourier transform the retarded Green's function with respect to relative time, and this gives us now a spectral function, or kind of spectral function, which still depends on the average time. And similarly, we can Fourier transform the lesser Green's function with respect to relative time, and this gives us an occupation function which still depends on the average time. And if we want, we can calculate this ratio, but there is no guarantee that this has the form of a spectral function and of a Fermi distribution function, and it in general will look very different from the Fermi distribution function. But it can be nevertheless interesting to calculate this to see how kind of far or close we are to an equilibrium state with a Fermi distribution function. So we can be a little more ambitious and really try to properly model the photo emission, for example, spectroscopy measurement, where we have a certain envelope for the probe pulse, which I denote by S. And then one can more or less derive the proper formula for the time-resolved photo emission spectrum, which looks very similar to the one which I showed before. It's the Fourier transform of this lesser Green's function with respect to relative time. But in addition, we have to multiply by some of these pulse envelope functions. And this spectral function, in contrast to the previous one, which I have defined simply by Fourier transformation without these factors here, is really guaranteed to be positive. And it also satisfies or contains the time-energy uncertainty relation, in the sense that if I probe with a very short pulse, a delta function-like pulse, I lose all the frequency information. I just measure the occupation function at the probing time, whereas if I have a very broad measuring pulse, I have a good kind of spectral resolution, but of course I average at the same time over many, over a large interval. So yeah, there is this time energy uncertainty relation built into this formula. So that's all I wanted to say about the theory in the last 15-20 minutes. I now want to show two applications of this formalism to simple but somehow interesting problems. And the first problem is AC field quench in the metallic phase of the Hubbard model. So we start from a metallic system and we suddenly switch on AC electric field with a frequency omega and a field amplitude E. And to track what's going on in this system, we will measure the double occupation as a function of time. And here we consider a Hall field model. So in a repulsively interacting case, the Hall field model will have a double occupation which is smaller than 1/4. So in the repulsively interacting case, double occupation in an equilibrium system at least is always below 1/4. whereas if we had an attractive interaction, the double occupation would be larger than 1/4. And now what we do here is measure now with non-equilibrium DMFT, and actually this is based on Monte Carlo impurity solver, so it's numerically exact within DMFT. What we measure is the evolution of this double occupation for different amplitudes of the driving field. And what you can see is that for small amplitude E, the double occupation goes down, which indicates that somehow the interaction strength in the system is enhanced, because the double occupation is suppressed if the interaction is larger. But then if we crank up the field even more at some point, the double occupation goes up, and what is quite remarkable is that it crosses this threshold of 1/4, which cannot be crossed in equilibrium even if we go up to infinite temperature. So this indicates that somehow the driving converts the repulsive interaction into an attractive interaction. And that's kind of an interesting result, because, for example, we know that the attractive Hubbard model has a far higher superconducting transition temperature than the repulsive Hubbard model, because we have kind of local pairing compared to D-wave pairing. So, of course, when we calculated this, we were wondering, is this a path towards dynamically generated high-temperature superconductivity? Anyhow, let's try to understand where this sign change comes from. And to understand this, it's enough to look at the one-dimensional problem. So let's consider a one-dimensional chain and an electric field in the direction of the chain. And we will take for the electric field this cosine form. So the amplitude is E, and we drive with cos omega t. And as we discussed before, we will use a gauge where the field is the time derivative of the vector potential. So this defines now the vector potential as E over omega minus E over omega times sine omega t. And that's why we always see this ratio E over omega appearing in this analysis. This is the amplitude of the vector potential in the driven state. Now we do this Pyle substitution in the calculation. We shift the dispersion epsilon of k by this time-dependent vector potential. And the first thing we can do to get some intuition is to average now this time-dependent dispersion over one period of the driving field. That's what we do here. And what comes out is that the time-averaged dispersion is just the original dispersion, but multiplied by a Bessel function of E over omega. And the Bessel function is sketched here, so you can see it has sign changes as a function of E over omega. And so basically what's happening is that once we get into the negative region here, we somehow convert the interaction from repulsive to attractive. So let's kind of sketch what's going on really in the system. We start from this half filled cosine band. That's our one-dimensional system at half filling in equilibrium. The lower half is occupied by electrons. And now we start to apply a periodic electric field with small amplitude, which means the electrons now wiggle back and forth within this band. And if we do the time averaging, or on average, kind of the dispersion is a little bit renormalized because of this wiggling. And the occupation stays in the same place due to if we average. Now we drive more, so we wiggle more strongly. The dispersion is more strongly renormalized. And if we wiggle even more than this, at some point, actually the dispersion is flipped, but the occupation still is stuck in the same place on time average, so which means that we now end up with a state which has an inverted dispersion and an inverted population in this inverted band. And so this corresponds to a negative temperature state. So in a negative temperature state, we have the high energy states occupied and the low energy states empty. So we end up in a state which has a repulsive interaction, but a negative temperature. Now we have to understand that this is equivalent to a state with an attractive interaction and a repulsive
and the positive temperature. And this can be done by basically looking at the density matrix. Let's suppose we are now in a state with negative temperature and a negative Bessel factor. So we have an inverted band due to the driving. Then we can pull out this negative Bessel factor here in front and define an effective temperature, T over J0, which is, in this case, positive. But then we have, at the same time, to divide the positive repulsive interaction by this Bessel factor. So that's how we can see that we can map this driven system to an effective model with a positive temperature, but with a negative effective interaction, which is the original interaction divided by this, in this case, negative Bessel factor. So that's how we can kind of understand this mapping or this transition to an effectively attractive state. Now, let's come back to superconductivity for a minute. Can we now induce superconductivity in this system? That's something I recently, or last year, just for fun, tested with some simpler NCA solver. So I applied the same quench, AC field quench, which corresponds, if we talk in terms of U, to a quench from a weakly repulsive one to kind of optimally attractive, minus 2.5 in this system. And you can see the same result as previously. The double occupation goes up and saturates at a value substantially above 0.25. So we have induced this attractive state. But if we look now at the pair susceptibility, so I apply a small pair seed field and I measure the induced order parameter, what happens is it changes the sign. That's because the seed field also effectively changes sign if we do this transformation from positive to negative, or from negative to positive temperature. But the sad news is if we look at the value of the susceptibility, it's actually small. It's even smaller than in the initial state. So if you would go into a superconducting state, what we should see is now a kind of growth to infinity of this susceptibility. But instead, it saturates at a small value, and that's because of heating. So we convert the interaction to attractive, but at the same time, we kind of produce a non-equilibrium state, which is in some sense very hot. And so this hot, attractive state still has a small parent susceptibility. So we need some other tricks to cool down this state. So that's, I think, part of some ongoing research, if we can somehow use other tricks to cool this state down, and then maybe we can indeed induce a superconducting state in this way. Okay, so now we move on to the second example, which is the dynamics of symmetry broken phases. I will discuss the dynamics of an antiferromagnetic insulator on the weak coupling side in this Slater region of the phase diagram. But as I mentioned before, exactly the same kind of phenomena are expected if we would, for example, quench an attractive Hubbard model out of a BCS superconducting state. So here is the setup. We start in this position marked by the black dot inside the antiferromagnetic phase, and then we kind of ramp down the interaction in order to push the system into the paramagnetic phase. And the open dots basically show the equilibrium states that we reach after thermalization if we quench to different values of U. And so you see that once we quench below U1.5, we are expecting the system to thermalize in the paramagnetic state. So let's see what happens to the order parameter if we do this. So let's first look at this pink dot here. If we quench to a place still on the ordered side of the phase boundary, then if we measure the energy injected into the system, we expect the system to thermalize at the value corresponding to this arrow. And if we calculate the dynamics, what we see is the order parameter, this is the staggered magnetization, goes down, and then it oscillates around some value, which on these timescales is still quite a bit larger than this equilibrium value. Even more interestingly, if we look at the blue point here, we expect the system to thermalize in the paramagnetic state because we kind of end up on the paramagnetic side of the phase boundary. But still, on short timescales, what you see is clear amplitude oscillations around some finite value of the order parameter, even though we know in the long time limit we will end up in the paramagnetic system. And only once we quench far enough away from the phase boundary do we see some kind of exponential relaxation of the order parameter. So these dynamics here, a kind of amplitude oscillation around the trapped value of the magnetization, is quite similar or reminiscent of what one finds in this Hartree approximation, the simplest weak coupling type of approximation one can do. In this case, one can solve the MFT equations exactly, and the result looks something like this, quite similar to what we have seen previously, some oscillations around some non-thermal value of the order parameter. And if we quench too far enough away from the phase boundary, eventually we see, even in the Hartree approximation, an exponential relaxation. And what I should emphasize is that the phase diagram in the Hartree approximation looks quite different from that in the exact kind of DMFT calculation. The antiferromagnetic region is more stable in the Hartree approximation. So what we seem to find in the DMFT calculation is that in this region, where kind of the Hartree approximation still predicts an ordered state, at least on short time scales, we see a dynamics which is quite reminiscent of the Hartree dynamics. And then on longer time scales, we, as higher order interaction processes start to play a role, we start to deviate from the Hartree solution, and then we'll eventually approach the thermal equilibrium state. But on short time scales, close to the phase boundary, the dynamics is quite similar to that of the Hartree dynamics. And so it's also interesting then to analyze the frequencies of these oscillations and the decay constants of these exponential dephasings here. And what one gets is the following curves. So the amplitude mode kind of extrapolates to zero as we quench to weaker final interactions, and the inverse dephasing times also goes to zero. And the interesting fact is that these diverging point, or kind of the zero point where these timescales diverge, is different from the critical point in equilibrium where, under kind of adiabatic quench, we would make the transition from ordered to disordered. So there's somewhere kind of a non-thermal critical point which at least controls the short time dynamics of this system after a quench. And it's also interesting to look at these exponential decays here on a logarithmic scale. If we do this, we notice that this exponential decay actually also involves two time scales. There is an exponential dephasing, which is relatively slow and which kind of extrapolates to this non-thermal critical point. And then at longer times, we see an exponential thermalization, which is faster. And the time scale for this thermalization dynamics should, we haven't really checked this here, but we expect that this extrapolates to actually the thermal critical point. So there are two time scales in this dynamics. The short time dynamics is controlled by this non-thermal critical point. The long time thermalization is controlled by the thermal critical point. And so if we think in terms of an RG picture, we would have the initial state described by the antiferromagnetic fixed point, which becomes unstable as we quench the system, and we expect the system to flow to the paramagnetic fixed point, which describes the thermalized paramagnetic state. And naively, one would expect something like this, but what really happens is that somewhere in this Hamiltonian space, a non-thermal fixed point pops up, and initially the system flows towards this non-thermal fixed point, which is something similar to the Hartree fixed point. And as the system stays in the vicinity of this Hartree fixed point, we see these amplitude oscillations and this trapping in the non-vanishing magnetized state. And then only on longer times will we approach the paramagnetic fixed point, and that's when this kind of trapped magnetization starts to melt. And this is a concept which has been introduced in another community, kind of high energy community by Berges and others some time ago. This was in the study of, I think, bosonic field theories. And here in these DMFT equations of the Hubbard model, we see very much the same phenomenon. This kind of short time dynamics, kind of controlled by a Hartree type fixed point. Yeah, and that's it. So I kind of tried to illustrate the complexity of the dynamics which follows some quench or electric field perturbation with two examples. The first example was kind of a Floquet state, where we could see how the dispersion of the system and the interaction strengths of the system are effectively modified by the application of a time periodic field. And the second example was an example which showed how dynamical phase transitions can be quite non-trivial, how there are timescales which come in that are related to kind of non-thermal fixed points. And this can substantially then delay the thermalization process. And with this, I want to, of course, acknowledge the people who have done much of this work, or with whom I had the pleasure to collaborate over 10 or more years. So Martin Eckstein and Markus Koller, these are kind of the pioneers in this field in Germany. And now Dotsuchi, Takashi Oka, and Hideo Aoki are the pioneers in Japan of non-equilibrium DMFT. They have kind of developed some Floquet version of dynamical mean field theory. And then I also want to acknowledge Hugo Strand and Denis Goles and Yuta Murakami, who are former postdocs who have significantly contributed to the development of non-equilibrium dynamical mean field theory. And so here are two reviews for kind of standard equilibrium DMFT. I think Ortwan's review is still probably a very good resource to get started. And we have written a review a couple of years ago, which I think is still more or less a good starting point to learn about non-equilibrium DMFT. And with this, I thank you for your attention.